Welcome to the Opium Den Interviews. I'm Daniel Williams. Today is Thursday, May 28th, 2009. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Alan St. Pierre, the Executive Director of Normal. And Alan will bring us up to date on what's going on with Normal and the state of drug policy here in the United States. So I hope you enjoy it. It's a beautiful day down here in Southwest Florida, and I'm hoping it's a beautiful day up in Washington, D.C., where Alan is. So we're going to try to make this call and see if we can get through here. Well, there it's ringing at least. Spoke to Alan.
Thank you for calling Normal. How can I help you?
Yes, Daniel Williams from the Opium Den for Alan St.
All right, let's try this one more time.
Okay, thank you.
Put you on hold and it should work this time.
Great, thanks. Yeah, we've had a little difficulty getting a hold of Alan. We've been trying since 11 o'clock. I spoke to him a couple of times, but couldn't seem to get their telephone system to cooperate with ours here in the studio. But we should be with Alan.
Hi, Alan.
Hello, Alan.
Hello.
Hey, Daniel Williams at the Opium Den. How are you?
Good.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to join us here today. And
sure.
How's things up in Washington, D.C. today?
Beautiful spring day.
You know, it's kind of a beautiful day down here in Southwest Florida. Our humidity is returning pretty rapidly, but no real complaints. Like I said, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. So why don't we, I kind of introduced you at the top of the interview. So tell us what's going on with Normal these days.
Well, it's busiest probably period in the organization's 39-year history. There are more states looking at decriminalizing, medicalizing, or in some cases actually legalizing cannabis. The change of presidency, the people that he's appointed, the policies that they seem to be moving in the direction of changing, all make it a very, very busy time at the organization.
Well, that's good. You guys do good work, and you are the oldest organization for drug policy in the country, so that means a lot to a lot of your followers and to a lot of the people in drug policy. So how long have you been at the helm there?
Well, I've been the head of the Normal Foundation since 1997 and the head of both Normal and the Normal Foundation proper since 2005.
That's right, because I was out in San Francisco at the 2006 Normal Convention, and I think that's when they kind of passed the bong baton from Keith over to you. I think that was around that time, was it not?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, good. I want to go ahead. Okay. What I'd like to do, I'd like to talk about a couple of issues. Let's talk about some of the legalization schemes that are being proposed, specifically the one out in California where they want to legalize marijuana for not just medicinal purposes but for recreational purposes, and they wanted to stick a $50 per ounce tax on marijuana. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's the first foray into the realm of bringing cannabis above ground entirely and not under the auspices of medical cannabis, which in California, unlike most of the other 12 states that have medical marijuana laws, by far they have the most lax disease range or types that people can qualify for. So hundreds of thousands of people in California for the better part of 10 years have been engaged in a quasi-legal Main Street purchasing of cannabis. So it appears that there is a serious debate afoot in California to go beyond medical and to tax non-medical non-medical cannabis at about $50 per ounce. This could raise billions of dollars, probably one to two immediately, in California in just pure taxes, based on an estimate of $12 to $15 billion a year of gross sales currently in the state for medical and non-medical cannabis.
Well, with regards to the tax issue, do you believe that a $50 per ounce tax is reasonable? That's $800 a pound, and you know, when you do the math, I would think that would be a a great encouragement for people to grow their own, and it would also minimize the tax revenue for the state. Do you think that that's too high of a tax?
I don't know. I'm not an economist, and I think ultimately most of us will be watching and agitating our legislators to set the taxes at a rate that is appropriate. Myself, I don't personally have a view whether $50 is too high or too low. Myself, I've been paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars of prohibition taxes on cannabis my whole life, illegally. And so if it would reduce the entire cost of cannabis, and you know, right now the only model that really exists in modern economy today where a product is grossly overtaxed as a means of social engineering is tobacco, most notably, alcohol included. In New York City, for example, today, a pack of cigarettes is between $9.50 to $11. Yet the cost of production and marketing, et cetera, is probably close to 40 cents to 70 cents. So most all the cost built into tobacco today is the four levels of taxation, local, county, state, and federal. So there are models today where there are, for lack of a better term, vice products that are sold that are taxed at exceedingly high rates, but are not set high enough to start off a so-called black market. We'll likely see in the years to come whether a $10, $12, $13 a pack cost will set off a black market in tobacco. Arguably, it already has. There's more cases of people exporting tobacco products from Virginia and the Carolinas and Kentucky, where they traditionally have very low taxes on tobacco. So at some point, there needs to be a system that will logically respect the free market and acknowledge that there will be a price point that will bring in tax revenue, and well over 95% of those who want to consume those products will likely buy them on the free market. The example here is beer, wine, jams, jellies, tobacco products. All those people can grow, but very few people do. Only real aficionados tend to do so, and because the free market generally brings those products to us in greater diversity, at lower price points, with little or no harassment or trouble in producing those products. They're consistent. So if marijuana is to become legal anytime soon, my own personal guesstimate is that 95 to 98% of the consuming market will go and purchase the product in a way very similar to about 99.9% of all products and services are already consumed in this country, and that a very small percentage, 2, 3% of people will go and grow their own cannabis, and they certainly should be allowed to do so. And Normal has always advocated that individuals should be able to grow their own, even though my own personal view is the free market will likely deliver the services better.
Well, that's true, and I got the gardener making a noise out the window. Sorry if that's giving you some static. But I visit Amsterdam on a fairly regular basis, and I look at the way their sales and marketing system goes, and it's about $6 a gram for pot, which makes it about $150, $160 an ounce, and they seem to be doing well with that. And I've also noticed that you know, a lot of my friends over there, and statistics when I speak to drug policy folks and some of the elected officials, over 75% of the people who visit the cannabis cafes and the like in Amsterdam are tourists, and that the majority of the locals I don't say if it's a majority, that's not an honest answer. They said quite a number of those who smoke at legal residents grow their own, and the idea of, you know, bringing products to market at a reasonable price and lowering the difficulty there. If tomatoes were $8 a piece at the grocery store, I think a lot of people would be growing their own tomatoes. So
absolutely,
it would seem a far more reasonable tax on marijuana would be in order. I mean, do you think that that would, I mean, would you, per, I don't want to say you personally, I don't want to put you on the line here, but do you think most people would pay, you know, an $800 a pound tax for pot and go to the markets because it's legal? Or do you think that would engender a lot of, little, you know, grow clubs and people growing a pound or two in their home each year?
Well, at $50 an ounce, that could, as I mentioned earlier, there's a tipping point regarding the black market. I think the bill that Amiano introduced in California begins at $50, but I think within it, it's pretty clear that it would be set based upon existing market forces. So my guess is it's going to come down ultimately to look similar to taxes that we see for tobacco products, which is that it doesn't really cost much to grow vegetable matter outdoors. It costs some to package it. It costs some to promote it. It costs some to distribute it. But outside of that, and done with great massive efficiencies at scale of economy, I've seen estimates where indoor cannabis grown at 50,000 square feet costs about $35 to $40 an ounce to produce, with lights, water, nutrients, people handling it, people chopping it, people drying it, and by the time you bring it to market, you can your costs are about $35 to $40. And so, you know, what's the fair profit on that? Well, compared to other commodities, probably a 20, 30% markup. So that's marijuana grown indoors that has all these inherent indoor costs. Outdoors, just like tobacco is grown, the costs are astronomically low. A pound of marijuana could be produced for a few pennies, a few dollars at most. So ultimately, if cannabis is to be treated like corn and sorghum and soybeans and grapes and tomatoes and barley and hops and all these other products that are true commodities that are grown and sold in mass amounts, then there's no way that a $50 an ounce of cannabis will stand, because that's not where the free market will trigger.
Yeah, I agree with you right there. And it seems that, you know, for the past 40-odd years, they've been hunting down all of us pot smokers with the intent of arrest and jail. And now they say, well, okay, we're not going to hunt you down anymore, but we're going to beat you up with a tax. It doesn't seem like they're really trying to give us much of a break there. But we'll see how the schemes come out, and if, in fact, we get anything of real value there, real merit. But I want to ask your opinion. This I speak to whenever I speak to anyone, I ask them about Jim Webb's National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009. I'd like to get your take on that.
Oh, it's an excellent idea. One of the first recommendations Normal made to the Dew administration in November and December of this past year, once it became clear who got elected, et cetera, was that we need a commission. Normal was advocating for a Schaefer Commission 2.0, the idea that when such political hot potatoes like the war on some drugs festers such that it does, that there needs to be a blue ribbon commission, and if passes prologue, we know that from all prior other Occidental commissions going back to the 1880s, every single one of these recommend at a minimum that a drug like marijuana be decriminalized, if not legalized. And we're pretty confident that a blue ribbon commission sitting down again, and that's allowing all sides, law enforcement, prohibitionists, anti-prohibitionists, doctors, lawyers, advocates, patients, etc., everybody gets to testify. And again, it passes prologue, the commission will recommend that the laws be substantively reformed. And to have a genuine moderate Democrat coming from a state like Virginia, of all places, leading the charge is so important as compared to having this be led by somebody, say, from California or Massachusetts, to use two examples. And that Jim Webb is, you know, a Democrat probably in name only. He had been a Republican most of his life and successfully ran against Senator Allen a few years ago as a Democrat. But it gives him this great position as somebody who served in the military, served in war, is a genuine intellectual on his own right, to look at the American prison system and say, this is a cancer. This is a terrible thing that we do in this country. How is it that we have prison incarceration levels similar to only Russia and China? And we don't have anything close to the kind of moderate levels that we see in places like Canada, all of Central and South America, and most certainly all of Western Europe. So it's a great thing to see that a near freshman in the Senate, the junior, I guess now the senior senator from Virginia, is leading this charge and recruiting a number of other moderates to come on board with him.
Well, isn't it kind of like the movie Groundhog Day? Because back in 72, Richard Nixon had a National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, and the recommendations there were that marijuana be decriminalized or even legalized. And that's been, that's 37 years ago. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a sense of deja vu or Groundhog Day here? I mean, do we really need another blue ribbon commission to come up with results that have been time and again found to be the same?
Well, reformers certainly don't, but the body politic does. There is little to no genuine support for reform of marijuana laws in the Congress, or for that matter in most state houses. So blue ribbon commissions are the moderate time buying way for the body politic to engage in a tough problem that they know they can't deal with in subcommittees and in the floor of their respective bodies. So these commissions, by a couple of years, they allow both sides to feel like they're part of the process. And at least in the case of reformers, we're willing to take the gamble that once again the results will be reform. And what we saw with the Nixon Commission, of course, which is in today's bittersweet world of the internet, that you can actually listen to Richard Nixon because the idiot recorded all of his inner office workings, and you can actually hear him arguing with Governor Schaefer, the very conservative Republican governor from Pennsylvania who was appointed to head up the commission. You can hear him after he's told that the commission is going to opine that marijuana be decriminalized, that he goes off on an outrageous anti-Semitic rant about the entire legalization effort is led by Jewish psychiatrists.
Oh, I know. I've listened to all the tapes myself, and actually, I feel kind of proud. The smoking gun tape that they made on June 23rd, 1972 was my birth. Mm-hmm. Was my birthday. So I took great pleasure in that. But
it's just amazing to see that. You know, so essentially that report was dead on arrival, that we can now hear in a historical context that Nixon had no intent to actually, he bought those 2 years. He didn't have to deal with the topic of marijuana from 69 to about 71. Well, he declared the report DOA, but it didn't stop normal and what we call the road crew from taking that report like a writ from government and going to all 50 states and getting then 10 of the 50 states to decriminalize marijuana based on that report. So while, yes, very frustrating to go through these commission reports, even if this administration puts together a commission and they too jadedly kill it in a dead-on-arrival type fashion, I'm sure that in today's world of the internet, reformers will take that as a writ and go back out and get another 10 or 15 states to keep on this trend of decriminalization and medicalization of cannabis.
Well, I'm hopeful, but not too hopeful, that President Obama will have a different reaction than President Nixon did. But one of the issues that kind of bothers me about the commission, not the fact that it's just another one, but it's going to probably take about 2 years from start to finish. And
yep.
I've asked Ethan and Chris Crane, all of the folks out there, this question. In that interim period, there'll be approximately 1.5 million, mostly younger Americans, arrested for the simple possession of marijuana and thrown into the criminal justice system that Jim Webb is ostensibly trying to review here. What does drug policy reform? What do we say to that 1.5 million individuals? I mean, do we just call them collateral damage, as one of my guests have said before, or what about that?
Well, I'm not sure what we say to them as a collective, because they as a collective are wantonly, willingly breaking the existing law. And I think anybody who breaks the law, whether they do it for therapeutic reasons or for religious reasons or for recreational reasons, have to be willing and wantonly to confront the government that's trying to oppress them. The problem, a huge problem, is well over 99% of people who get arrested on drug charges never lift a finger to reform the laws, not at all, even though they can join organizations like NORMAL and 30 other drug policy reform organizations that are chartered in the United States and are reached as easily as typing the word marijuana into a search engine. So those individuals, while they will technically be collateral damage, they do not need to be coddled to, because they, frankly, from my point of view, are one of the major reasons why reform has taken so long and 70 years of prohibition has lasted, is because those individuals, we know statistically and historically, do nothing to reform the laws. So I wish them the best of luck when they get busted, and that when they realize how problematic prohibition is, they should then join organizations to reform the laws. But sadly, as I often complain to reformers, that less than 0.01% of consumers of cannabis are involved with the reform of the laws. So the penetration rate by reform organizations, by getting, from my jaded point of view, incredibly non-political, non-active, subservient citizens to a government that they tax, that they fund through their taxes, that they allow to govern them through their votes, that they go to the voting booths and historically vote for people who would put them in jail. So, yes, they will be collateral damage. But
well, every election that I've voted in since 1972, after they changed the law, it was 22 and 72, and I would suggest that probably every president that you voted for and every senator and governor, you voted for someone who wants to put us in jail as well.
No, actually, I don't. I actually really consciously do not vote for anybody who would put me in jail. And so, no, I try to stop that self-abuse some time ago in my life.
So you've quit voting? Because I don't know of a candidate out there.
No, I vote for parties and individuals who I know, I have talked to, they have sent me information indicating whether they support cannabis law reform. And if they don't support cannabis law reform, I'll vote for another individual.
So did you vote
for... Thankfully, in most of the ballots I've had the opportunity to my chance to vote for, I've had an alternative to vote for. None of them have prevailed. Most of them usually win less than 2% of the vote.
So you didn't vote
for
him.
I won't vote. For example, I didn't vote for Bill Clinton. I didn't vote for George Bush.
Did you vote for Obama?
I did not vote in the District of Columbia for this presidential election because I think I was actually out of town. So I did not even vote in this past. In the District of Columbia, Obama's going to win 99% of the vote. So symbolism aside, I didn't vote for in this particular presidential election.
Well, that kind of goes to your point of your feelings of for all those stoners out there who don't vote. Their apathy almost means that they deserve the situation they get themselves into.
Well, I make a big distinction between voting in a virtually all black district that's going to vote for the first black president, and individuals who get busted. And while we're talking now, seven of our 10 lines here at NORMAL are lit with people who almost certainly have been arrested for marijuana, and what they're calling for is, can NORMAL represent them for free? Can
right.
NORMAL give them free legal? And so when we try to let them know, there really is no free legal help, that you have been arrested for a drug charge, you are now responsible for this. And individuals want somebody else to essentially be responsible for their own actions. So I think the more people would be responsible for their own actions, the less likely prohibition would last as long as it has.
Well, what do you think of the Libertarian Party? They've had a principled position against drug prohibition since founding in 1972. What should we not vote Libertarian every election then, presidential election?
Well, I mean, NORMAL is a non is a
I understand that. Right.
Yeah, so my own personal view is the Libertarian Party is not a party per se. It's a political concept. So we're kind of straddled in this country between Democrats and Republicans in terms of who will actually win an election and govern. So the Libertarian Party, I think, is an important factor in Republicanism in this country, in this case, in the modern epoch, that if one goes to a GOPAC meeting, for example, in the last 4 or 5 years, that's pretty well split between free market, libertarian, pro-business types and social conservative moralists. And so the GOP is sort of being ripped and torn by these two different components. And yes, libertarians have always had as a principal component of their philosophy that drug prohibition is inconsistent with the free market.
Well, what did you make of Ron Paul's ability to raise $37 million during his run for the White House as a Republican candidate? There were a lot of issues that resonated with Ron Paul supporters, but it seemed the two biggest ones were his military position of removing all of our troops from overseas, not just the Middle East, and ending the drug war. That seemed to be the two points that meant most to the young people that I spoke to traveling around the country during that time.
Oh, no doubt. He definitely activated a lot of people on those topic matters, and the ability to raise money was eye-popping, and I'm sure is going to be very instructive for future generations of Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians about what issues do they want to advocate for online and where they could actually see some serious donations. The unfortunate aspect of the Ron Paul campaign was none of that financial support equated to votes. I don't know that he got more than 5% in any primary he was in, which by all accounts means, as sad as it is to say, abject failure. So his ideas were important, but at least regarding Mr. McCain, had he been elected, it didn't appear that he was adopting any of Mr. Paul's views on marijuana policy reform or the military. So Ron Paul's, for me, as somebody who really enjoys watching and participating in politics, was fascinating to watch. But I think overall, Americans are not libertarian, and generally speaking, when it comes to third parties, are about 95% against third parties, according to the vote patterns of the last 40 years.
Well, let's talk about current voting patterns. What was your take on candidate Obama with regards to drug policy, and now what we have President Obama? Are you disappointed? Are you mad? Are you hopeful? Do you feel like you got screwed? What do you think?
No, I mean, having been working in downtown D.C. for almost 20 years, politicians are hardly ones to look to for continuity or clarity. I've never seen any politician yet who's been able to maintain a public and private persona on the issue of something as general as crime and drugs. Obama as a candidate, well, what did he say? He, just like every Democratic candidate, was inclined to favor a moderation of the medical marijuana policies at the federal level, just simply speaking to the fact that if elected, that he would end the federal harassment of legitimate state-compliant providers. And he did a complete and utter full flip-flop on the issue of decriminalization. He, as again mentioned earlier, the bittersweet internet can bring us through things like Yahoo and YouTube, images and videos of Obama as a Senate candidate, as a lecturer at the University of Chicago, on the stump, absolutely clearly endorsing succinctly the idea of decriminalizing marijuana. In May of last year, in the final throes of a tough primary battle with Mrs. Clinton, and the Clintons had always been anti-cannabis, that the Washington Times, a conservative paper, called normal, indicating that they were about to publish a piece on Obama's decriminalization stance and wanted to know whether we had any further information than they had, and we weren't keen on providing any more to them that they had already were ready to publish. Contacted the Obama administration before the Obama camp before they were to publish, and got them to comment at the last second that he in fact does not support decriminalizing marijuana, and if elected would rigorously enforce federal law. Well, that is a complete 180-degree flip-flop to what he had said all throughout his ascendancy in Illinois and to the Senate. So, again, I've seen politicians lie. I know many politicians who use cannabis and stand before cameras and lie to beat the band. So,
well, let's out them. Why can't we out them?
Some choose to out. Some choose not to out. I don't favor outing individuals personally. So that's not a mode that Normal or myself is going to endorse, at least while I'm on the board and running the organization. But for those who have that kind of information and want to publish it, they certainly can do so.
Do we need a Larry Flint of the cannabis world?
I guess if there is such. So the Obama administration, as they came into power, they quickly acknowledged that they were going to make these changes on the medical marijuana front in the West Coast, and they haven't had any raids per se since they took power entirely. However, in given two opportunities to dial back on medical marijuana, notably the Charles Lynch case and the Brian Eppes case, they apparently are allowing these individuals' prosecutions under the Bush administration to go forward to, in the case of Brian Eppes, to go back to jail after being out for 6 years on an appeal bond. This administration, I think, quite frustratingly, is not doing the right thing here and is going to put this guy back in jail, not wanting to touch the hot potato that the Bush administration created. They have appointed a new drug czar who, while very, very different in style and manner than the prior drug czars, McCaffrey and Walters, he appears pragmatic on many different levels as the former chief of police of Seattle, who implemented, though he didn't favor, but he pragmatically implemented decriminalizing marijuana, medicalization of marijuana, needle exchange. The Seattle Hemp Fest happens under the watch and noses of hundreds and hundreds of police officers with little or no arrests for, despite massive open-air cannabis consumption. So he now has been in office less than a month. However, his rhetoric has not lit reformers on fire. And 1 month into the job, it'd be hard to embrace the rhetoric he's taken on, but he's got arguably between 4 to 8 years to try to articulate a very different policy than the prior administrations. But none of us know that because the executive branch isn't indicating to the public at all what their plans are regarding criminal justice reform, drug policy reform. And when given the opportunity in a modern internet-driven age to get direct feedback from the public about what the public's concerns are regarding specifically the economy. Well, in that press conference about a month and a half ago, the number one question generated to the White House's webpage on what is the most important economic concerns of Americans was legalizing marijuana.
And Obama blew us off.
And Obama laughed it off. And so
Do you think that's going to cost him? I mean, do you young people are pretty fickle in most categories. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I mean, I'm not saying that everybody who voted for Obama, every young person mm-hmm. is a stoner, but I think there was a significant amount of voters out there who believed in candidate Obama's rhetoric. And mm-hmm. do you think the fickle nature of young people will come back to bite him in the ass if he doesn't do another 180?
Hard to say. I mean, people's memories are short. This happened in the first 60 days of his administration. He's got a lot more to go. So if he actually makes some pragmatic changes that reformers embrace, the people will probably look back at that press conference and themselves chuckle at the nature of it. But as it is, my guesstimate is that they don't want to touch this policy at all in the first 3+ years of the administration. They don't want Congress to take it up at all. The leaders in the House acknowledge to Normal and the Drug Policy Alliance and the American Civil Liberties Union, all of whom we work together in lobbying. They all indicate that they, meaning the leaders in the Democratic Party, say, we support this issue, but with two wars going on, the economy in ruins, huge changes going on in health care, et cetera, this is not an area that they're willing to take on and effectively have told us such. So I don't think we're going to see hardly any positive reforms coming out of the federal government. And I think has been the case for the last 10 to 15 years, most of the substantive reforms are going to happen at the state level. The law is where you live. Very few of us will ever interface with a federal law enforcement agency, but many of us have an opportunity quite readily every day to interface negatively with our local police, our county police, our state police. So in the case of my home state of Massachusetts, decriminalizing marijuana this past November, with Michigan voters voting 63% to be the first Midwest state to move towards medical marijuana, with, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that there are many, many states looking at reforming the laws, those are where the substantive reforms are likely going to happen that really affect people's lives, not here in Washington, D.C.
Well, let's talk about medical marijuana for a second. Do you believe that that's the right strategy to move the drug debate forward?
Well, I don't know if it's the right strategy. One can argue, going back to the mid-1980s, as Normal did, that when you looked at all the different issues put before people about what were the ones that they most ported regarding some aspect of drug policy reform, and basically, outside of needle exchange, there's not really any support for reform outside of cannabis. So specific to Normal's charter, cannabis only, in the 1980s, one could quickly start to measure that even before the term medical marijuana was part of the lexicon, that Americans made a distinction between the non-medical use of a drug that was helpful to them and the recreational use of it that was to remain illegal. So starting around 1989-1990 in California, in their state legislature, in 1992 with the passage of Proposition P in San Francisco, and then later, in my view, the single largest cataclysmic change in drug policy reform happened in November of 1996 when voters voted in California in the majority for medical access to marijuana. So from that point forward, one can argue that there have been leaps and bounds made in all kinds of areas of drug policy reform, most notably around marijuana, quite specifically around medical marijuana law reform. Since 1996, now 12 other states have medical marijuana laws, equaling 75 million Americans. 13 states now have decriminalized marijuana, equaling 115 million people in the United States. So when it comes to medical marijuana, we look at the big macro charts of public opinion going back to the 1960s, and they remained quite flat and static at around the 20 percentile when individuals were asked, do you think marijuana should be legalized? Starting in 1996, after the biggest state in the union, the sixth largest economy on earth, voted for medical marijuana, and today you can buy medical marijuana 24/7 in a vending machine in the Los Angeles basin, that today one can strongly point to the notion that medical marijuana is at the vanguard of drug policy reform, because when we look at the numbers, 75% of Americans support medical access to marijuana, 73% of Americans support decriminalizing marijuana, and my larger point here is that between 1996 and 2008, the numbers for legalizing marijuana, depending on what data set you look at, are between 42%, which is what Normal concentrates on, or some recent flash surveys, as they're known, indicating that upwards of 52% of Americans now support legalizing marijuana. So there's no doubt that from a macro statistical point of view, that with the passage of medical marijuana in California in 1996, that is the sui generis of the rising of the larger support in population for the overall legalization of marijuana.
Well, don't you think we run the risk of coming into a situation where, you know, the difficulty that we've had in getting just medical marijuana to be the law of the land, let's say it does become the law of the land, mm-hmm. the great resistance that we've had just to medical marijuana, if we get that law of the land, do you think the prohibitionist will look at us and say, you know, we gave you medical marijuana, now, you know, sit down, shut up, and leave us alone? Do you think that we're going to be able to move forward? Because when I speak to drug policy people privately, I know their mm-hmm. their groups have specific goals, but when I speak to them privately, every single one of them says that repealing drug prohibition is the end game. So once we get marijuana done, even if it's for the recreational use, to move the debate forward, they've got to come up with a new drug. So I asked them, I mean, what is next? If you get marijuana done, what drug will you champion next? Mm-hmm. And they don't really have a good answer. And I'm thinking that if we do get marijuana regulated and controlled for recreational and medicinal use, it will be a very difficult struggle to move forward and get other prohibitions released. And then we run the backlash of legalizing marijuana does nothing to really change the dynamic of the crime and the corruption and the disease. Mm-hmm. And there could be a backlash against medical marijuana and going back to try to recriminalize it. What's your thoughts, sir?
Absolutely. In fact, Normal, going back to 1970s, sort of predicted most of this happening if we didn't ethically, consciously approach this quandary, a real cannabis conundrum, if you will. And that is this. We call it the boxed canyon phenomena, and we don't want to be in a box canyon of medical marijuana only. I don't work at Normal 70 to 80 hours a week since 1991 for medical marijuana. Medical marijuana patients, in my view and that of the boards, is that they should be the first in line. That is the moral imperative. You're sick, dying, or sense threatened, you should be able to access medical cannabis. And that has been at the vanguard ethically of the reforms. However, because today there is a balkanization in drug policy reform such that there are only medical marijuana only groups today that their charter and their mission statement and their lobbying is only for medical marijuana, and when they do their lobbying they will often juxtapose them to us, and they are describe us, meaning Normal, the Marijuana Policy Project, the ACLU, the Drug Policy Alliance, MAPS, etc. We're labeled legalizers in their lobbying efforts.
Yeah, it's used as a pejorative term. It's just why I don't like the term legalization. I like the term repealing prohibition.
Mm-hmm. But so this is a definite quandary behind the scenes in drug policy reform, in that when there is an advocacy group out there that's advocating for only one very small aspect of a much larger reform, and considering that, as I mentioned just moments ago, that medical marijuana law reform clearly enjoys the lion's share of public opinion. So the difficulty is in two levels here, Daniel, and that is, one, this idea of the box canyon and only advocating for medical cannabis, when from the very beginning, Normal's always advocated for the legalization of marijuana.
And you're to be applauded. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're to be applauded for that. I have a great respect for your organization, specifically because you don't make a distinction between recreational and medicinal use. I think that's to your credit, and it needs to be. I think that particular philosophy needs to move into some of the other drug policy reform groups as well.
You're kind to say it's something that, you know, has, I think, kept the organization together for all these 39 years, is that in the end, at a normal board meeting, there are people there from the hemp industry, there are people there from the medical marijuana industry, if you will, there are people there for the legalization. And yet we all work together recognizing that all of these arguments individually are good enough to reform the laws. Put together, it only multiplies and magnifies the argument. So I've always felt blessed as a public speaker to get up, and I can talk at dissertation length about the joys and wonders of hemp, about medical marijuana, about the economics of legalization, and don't feel hampered to only be restricted to one component. That's one aspect. There's another one that we have to be really mindful of looking down the future, and that is the pharmaceuticalization of cannabis. And as medical marijuana is so supported by the general public, however, is generally not supported by the body politic and those who represent us in the state houses and here in Congress, that if given the opportunity to do what we call here at Normal Marinol Redux, the idea that, all right, there's a pill, there's a delivery system that is a proprietary pharmaceutical product that is highly controlled, that the government will quickly ban the vegetable, the whole smoked component
exactly.
of cannabis.
Exactly.
And so while as a free marketer myself, I believe that if individuals want to use pharmaceuticalized cannabis, fine, that's their choice. But for those of us who maybe don't want to use those pharmaceutical products and either want to buy the whole smoke product or, going back to an earlier topic, grow our own medicine, then we should be able to do that unfettered by the law. And I'm afraid that and I'll use just one brand name here, GW Pharmaceuticals, and that's only one of about 20 that are coming onto the market in the next 10 years or so, that these products, their business model can only exist functionally if marijuana is kept illegal and the patients who use it are treated like criminals. So there are serious, serious battles being waged behind the scenes regarding those who only favor medical marijuana and in some ways embrace the notion of pharmaceuticalization, and those of us who say, well, if you want to use a patch or an eye drop or a suppository or a sublingual spray under your tongue, fine. But if I want to grow a plant in my backyard or in my closet and I want to harvest that and use that as a medicine, I should be able to do so.
Well, with regard to Marinol and the pharmaceutical aspect of it all, it seems to me that Marinol has not had the same results as smoked or edible cannabis. And I'm not so sure the pharmaceutical companies, maybe I'm naive, but I'm not so sure the pharmaceutical companies are so adamantly opposed to actually the plant itself, because it seems to me if we were to repeal drug prohibition and allow access to narcotics and drugs that are currently illegal now, allow access, you know, behind the counter without mm-hmm. prescription, it would seem that pharmaceutical companies, the real money would be in the in narcotics and not in in marijuana. If you mm-hmm. could walk into a CVS and buy a blister pack of 7.5 milligram Vicodins for $20, it would seem to me that's where the money is. Or, you know, half a gram of Coke for, mm-hmm. you know, for $50 or something. It would seem to me that would be where the money is. We can't grow our own Vicodins and we really can't make our own cocaine.
Right.
So wouldn't the money be
there? They're definitely
in
a position to deliver those drugs in a way that they were prior to the Harrison Narcotic Act.
Exactly.
2014.
Yes, exactly.
They are in the very best position to take a raw product that is grown often at very low cost in foreign countries with low labor, synthesize it, analog it in some form or another, and get it out there in a patented way.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's where the real money is. Now, I want to kind of talk about a touchy subject with you, if you don't mind. And it's the whole subject of decriminalization.
Mm-hmm.
And the primary definition, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but decriminalization removes the penalties for, you know, private possession and not being crazy, you know, responsible use of marijuana, and, you know, including, you know, cultivation. And even like Barney Frank and Ron Paul's bill, mm-hmm. the casual transfer for nonprofit amounts, but mm-hmm. the problem I have with that model is that my question is to all those who believe in decriminalization as the right course, And they, you know, they continue to maintain criminal sanctions against people who sell or traffic, you know, large amounts of the of marijuana. My question is, where do they think we get our fucking pot from the pot fairy? I mean, don't we get it from guys with 3 or 4 pounds in their garage that take care of all of us, giving us our individuals? I mean, isn't that just kind of dumb?
Well, decriminalization, by all measure, is a half-baked loaf, but it's the Hobson's choice that every single person confronted will take in a moment regarding either going to jail for their cannabis use or getting a small fine. So in the years of debating and lobbying and litigating for decriminalization, the difficulty is that it is a genuine halfway point. There is no support for legalizing marijuana in the United States. I can say at the political level, Tommy Amiano's bill in California at this date has how many co-sponsors? None. Zero. So even in California, the state that loves cannabis more than any other, a popular legislator at a time of incredible economic crises with a governor who has used marijuana, we can all watch him again on the blessed bitterness internet, we can watch the governor Schwarzenegger use marijuana in the 1970s as a bodybuilder, and just yesterday the number two question on Dig to Governor Schwarzenegger was, you know, should marijuana be legalized? Mr. Amiano still can't get a single co-sponsor of this legalization bill. In my home state of Massachusetts, there's a legalization bill, and that too has not attracted any co-sponsors. So the difficulty is that while you can get a bill introduced, which is great, it indicates some level of reform, if there are no co-sponsors and it doesn't move from subcommittee to committee to floor to being passed, I think it can be said succinctly that there is no political support for such. So as it is, medical marijuana at 75% support in the American population gets the politicians' attention. 73% support decriminalization, that gets their attention. But when we go to them now and say, well, whether you look at 42% or maybe 52% support legalization, they say that's not high enough. In politics, the Tip O'Neill maxim is, if you're at the 60 percentile, you're rolling over your opponents. It doesn't matter what their opposition is. So about a month ago, Nate Silver, who's sort of a whiz kid statistician that's beloved on cable news shows these days, contacted reformers and said, listen, I keep hearing this zeitgeist about marijuana everywhere in the media that, you know, should it be reformed, et cetera, et cetera. So can you send us all the data sets? And we want to try to estimate, at what point will there be 60% of Americans in favor of marijuana legalization, such that one can say at that point that, politically speaking, politicians can no longer oppose reforms. And his estimates are that by 2019, 2020, 60% of Americans will be lock, stock, and barrel in favor of legalization. And at that point, we'll be then talking about what should the taxation rates be, what will distribution look like. Right now, if we walk into, for example, even Barney Frank and Ron Paul's office, Ron Paul, this tremendous libertarian, is not willing to sponsor a legalization bill. Why? Because he would tell you, as he has told us, nobody else will support it with me. Even Barney Frank won't join the legalization side of it. So while drug policy reform has made huge strides in the last 35 years, here in Washington and in most state capitals where actual laws are made, promulgated, and institutionalized, sadly, regrettably, unfortunately, I can inform you and the listeners that we have not yet achieved that level of support in the body politic.
Well, let me ask you, everybody that I speak with tells me that, and I don't totally disagree, but I do to a point, that this is a grassroots, bottom-up effort to get to get drug prohibition repealed. But I think the issue is so so enormous and has so much so many repercussions into other aspects of foreign and domestic policy that it actually does require a top-down reform from the president. And you know, with Barack Obama's history of, as he says in his book, snorting coke and smoking weed, but he didn't do smack, which I thought was terminology they'd used tried to ingratiate himself to the drug crowd. But it requires a president to lead on this issue and mm-hmm. get the country behind him, because I believe, as you mentioned, these statistics are pretty high. There's a lot of people out there that support this. I mean, abortion's only got a 49% approval rating, and it's a deal. So why do you think Barack Obama is unwilling to? I mean, the great order that he is, the political capital that he has, and the support out there among the American public. Why do you believe he has not taken the lead and said, at the minimum, while the National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009 works through its process, he'll take marijuana out of Schedule One, mm-hmm. or make some type of policy speech to the American public to reorient this and to get this off the dime? Why do you believe he has not done that?
I think he's way too pragmatic to do anything like this. And with somebody like Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel was Bill Clinton's chief domestic policy advisor,
right,
and the
right.
person who opposed medical marijuana behind the scenes, I mean, really behind the scenes. When you go back to 1996 and the passage of this incredible vote in 1996 in California, you have the Clinton administration within 48 hours after that vote trying to stop Americans from having First Amendment conversations with their doctors. Mr. Holder, now the Attorney General, then the number three or four banana over at the Justice Department, he was out in California arguing for the Clinton administration that doctors and patients cannot have a private conversation about medical cannabis. Well, as we all know, blessedly, the First Amendment won in that case, and of course patients and doctors can have private conversations about medical cannabis. So Rahm Emanuel is a triangulation freak. The last thing that they're going to do from a domestic policy point of view is hand Republicans and social conservatives something to what is called triangulate on. And there is no doubt that if they were handed from the federal government, from the Obama administration, the idea that they were going to, quote, legalize marijuana, decriminalize marijuana, that they were going to do anything more than what they currently have done or said they're going to do, then they will have handed these vicious partisans on the other side of that table the issues they don't want to confront. So for purely political reasons, I don't think they're going to touch us with a 10-foot pole, even though they can do some amazing tweaks around the edges here. For example, and again, only wonks probably can appreciate this on some level. 4 days ago, the administration put out a memorandum to all heads of agencies. The memorandum was called Preemption. And this hasn't, as far as I know, been mentioned in the media at all. What this memo says to all heads of agencies, like the Drug Czar, like the DEA, like NIDA, etc., is what this memo says in general, which we would have never seen under Bush. We would have never seen under Mr. Clinton. What this memo says is that if your agency, your federal agency, is confronted with a situation at the state level where there appears to be a conflict between state interests and federal law, you are to defer and preempt to state laws and state mores and values unless there is a stark, stark conflict with federal law. That, to me, is a very good and tweak around the edge of where this administration can go to diminish these friction points that the last two administrations created between medical patients, for example, and law enforcement. Mr. Krulikowski, the new drug czar, if he would simply blunt the efforts of the past administrations, for example, when we're trying to do things at the state level, trying to reform, like in Connecticut, a decriminalization law, or in Delaware, a new medical marijuana bill was introduced 2 days ago, that under the McCaffrey and Walters drug czar's offices, they would have been in those states the next day. They would have literally parachuted into those states telling them, don't vote for this, tell your constituents, you got to get law enforcement, you got to get your health community up against all of this. My guess is, and from what I can see, the Obama administration is not going to be doing those type of things. So while they're not going to come out and say, let's decriminalize marijuana, they likely, and appear to be doing so, changing some things around the edges that really will have some substantive impacts without having to pay the political price for doing so.
Well, in 2008, I ran on the Libertarian ticket for I started out running for the presidential nomination, and then when Bob Barr came in, I stepped down to run for the vice presidential nomination. In our party, in the Libertarian Party, the delegates elect both the presidential and the vice presidential candidate, so there was two different races. And when Bob Barr finally got the nomination, it was a very contentious six-vote type of thing. And when it came down to the VP, where up until literally the day before, I was a lock, but when it looked like Bob Barr might win, they changed the rules to allow any presidential candidate who didn't win to automatically run for the vice presidential position without performing the prerequisites. So I went from a lock to nobody, but when the vice presidential vote came up, it was a contest between Wayne Allen Root and Steve Covey, and the first vote came out, and neither one of them got 50% plus one, and I came in third, but I had enough votes that I could determine who would be on the ticket. If I asked my supporters to go with Wayne Allen, he'd be on the ticket, and if I went with Steve Covey, he would be up be on the ticket. So between the first vote and the second vote, I was courted by Steve Covey's organization. They came up and said, listen, we want you to, you know, you're a drug guy, Steve Covey's a drug guy. We want you to give all your support to Steve Covey, because if we get him on the ticket, we can fuck Bob Barr. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why don't you guys give me, you know, your support and put me on the ticket, and we'll actually make this a real issue. Their sole intent was to screw Bob Barr out of doing any type of things positive for the Libertarian Party. So long story short, I put my support to Wayne Allen Root, and Bob Barr and Wayne became the ticket. Bob Barr, for that support, between the first and second vote, I was in the back of the convention hall, and it was, you know, it was politically the way you would think it was, you know, shaking hands, eyeball to eyeball. And Bob said, look, Dan, he goes, you know what we got to do here? We got to get Wayne on the ticket. He said, if you do that, he goes, you know, I'm no good on the drug issue. And I said, oh, I know you're not any good. He said, if you do that, I'll put you on the finance committee. We'll get you on TV. You can be our drug policy spokesperson. And I asked him, I said, does that mean medical marijuana or the whole ball of wax? And he goes, Dan, the whole ball of wax. So we shook hands. I went up, made my concession and endorsement speech. And then I was out in the cold within, 72 hours, and Bob Barr did absolutely nothing. But the point that I'm getting to is, had Bob Barr done something and actually made repealing prohibition, or at least stepping into the to the repeal, he would have raised an awful lot of money and received a much higher profile than he did. So that's why I think it's a top-down situation where, and like I said, Ron Paul demonstrated that there was a lot of money to be raised and a lot of awareness out there for repealing drug prohibition or ending the drug war. So this is what I'm rolling around to. Do you think that if the Libertarian Party puts up a candidate in 2012 that takes this on as a signature issue, he won't get elected, but do you think that would do more to change the debate than the National Criminal Justice Commission Act and all these little things?
It well could. For example, had Mr. Paul decided to bail out on the Republicans who weren't going to give him his due and run on the Libertarian Party ticket, he, because of his popularity and his ability to raise money, he would have continued to raise tens of millions of dollars. He, unlike the other candidates, did have some pretty good access to mainstream media and would have, as he still does, bless him, will almost always, when given the opportunity, talk about the need to reform drug prohibition laws in this country. So, yes, had in the future, when the third-party candidate does support either drug policy reform overall or at least marijuana law reform, in my view, that can only help this issue immensely. And, yes, it was very disappointing to see Barr walk away with a nomination and then, as far as I could see, show up almost nowhere in mainstream media, and when he did, certainly not drive home one of his tenant issues of libertarianism in the last 50 years.
Yeah, he squandered all of the media that he received, and as a Libertarian presidential candidate, he received more media attention than all of the previous presidential candidates combined. So there was great hope that Bob would would mm-hmm. be able to do something, and there was all equally great disappointment when he squandered all of his media trying to run with the big dogs, as opposed to coming out with clear policies that would differentiate him from Obama and McCain. So we've been here just about a little over an hour, Alan, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I want to give you the last couple of minutes to tell us what you think the future of drug policy is, and how quickly do you think we're going to get to all of our stated goals of ending drug prohibition?
Well, thank you, and certainly, the future is extremely bright. Every single measurable metric and indicator that we look at is on an upward swing. Donations, membership, web page hits, media interviews, columns, editorials, gatherings, bills in Congress, the type of litigation that's finding its way into the appellate court system now is truly boding well for reformers. So everybody can feel buoyed by that on some level. However, as I mentioned earlier, by this incredible vexation I have that such a teeny percentage of people who either use drugs like cannabis or have been arrested for a drug like cannabis ever get involved with their own liberation. So for me, we want to break that one percentile. We would like to see 1% of people who use cannabis or get busted for it actually get involved with their own liberation. This year coming up is one of the most momentous years, to be sure. I think that the outdoor festival season that begins in earnest now and will go right through November will be the biggest ever. The Boston and the Seattle Hemp Fests, the normal conferences and legal seminars are all looking to be the biggest and most crowded. So if there was ever a year that an individual who was interested in this topic but afraid to come out of their smoky closet, afraid of some sort of social or legal sanctions for them, speaking their mind, speaking to the ills of prohibition, this is the year to do it. There is, one can be vexed by the fact that one has held one's tongue for so long, but there's a lot of pragmatism to that. There's almost a Darwinian component in not risking one's self-organism for the greater good. But one of the things that moves humanity along is that collectivism of realizing that, well, we have got to hang together or we will surely hang separately here. And drug policy reform, mainly because of the graying of the baby boom generation taking over the reins of institutional power in this country, and who have a very different and I think more positive relationship with drugs like cannabis than the prior generations, as depicted by my grandmother or for that matter even my mother's generation. At 43 years old, I'm in the midst of a generation that decidedly wants reform, and between the internet and the funders of the major parties today, I mean, you mentioned earlier a top-down approach in all of this. Well, while grassroots is important in a social law reform movement, people like billionaires, like George Soros, Peter Lewis, and others, have donated tens of millions of dollars towards the building of this Democratic majority. If these two men, who have also put up more money for drug policy reform than anybody on earth, if they don't have the kind of entree that one presumes is obvious and necessary when you're giving that kind of money away, that if they yet don't have the ability to pick up the phone and say, Mr. Obama, Mr. Holder, Mr. Emanuel, we support you guys. We have given you literally hundreds of millions of dollars through the Democratic Party, MoveOn.org, blah, blah, blah. One of our major priorities is drug policy reform. And if they can't help drive these reforms, then jadedly put here, we really do have a much longer slog ahead of us here. I don't think that's the case, but if these billionaires can't get deference on the issues that they really care about, I think it's indicative of how hard a row we have left.
Well, that's very well put. It's not as encouraging as I hope, but you spoke your mind, and I appreciate that. And there's probably a lot of credibility to what you said. I do think we're in for a little longer slog, unfortunately, but things do change. They say people are reticent to change, but we have had fundamental change happen in our country overnight, and I think that there's a possibility that something like that could happen in drug policy. So Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML, I really want to thank you for joining us here in the Opium Den today. And I'd like to just close off by saying, stay healthy and high when it helps.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Daniel.
All right, Alan, thanks again. Bye now. Well, there we have it. Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML, spent about an hour and 8 minutes with me today. I certainly hope you you enjoy it. And send us your comments. Send us anything that you wish after you hear this interview with Alan St. Pierre, whether you agree with him on points or disagree with him on points. So until tonight, when we come back on live at 9 o'clock, thanks for downloading this interview, and as I said to Alan, stay healthy and high when it helps.